Ayatollah Khamenei says the U.S. assassination of General Soleimani was a miscalculation regarding Iran that only further strengthened the commander's campaign. Iraq's new parliament holds its first session amid heated debates and tension among the competing political parties. And the U.S. says it does not expect breakthroughs in its upcoming security talks with Russia, hours after Moscow ruled out any concessions to Washington. Thanks so much for being with us. First story takes us right here to Iran this hour, where the leader on the Islamic Revolution says the United States' assassination of Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani has only further strengthened the very campaign that the anti-terror commander set in motion. But the leader said Washington's miscalculations have resulted in the U.S. government making wrong decisions, which in turn have led to its failure. Elsewhere in his remarks, Ayatollah Khamenei noted that the United States' profound animosity toward the Islamic Republic emanates from the religious nature of Iran's establishment. According to the leader, tyrants have always been opposed to movements and establishment with a religious foundation. The leader delivered the speech on the anniversary of the 1978 uprising in Iran against the dictatorial rule of the then Pahlavi monarch. We've spoken to political analyst Mustafa Khoshchesh. Let's take a listen at what he has to say about the U.S. power in the region having been, it's waning since General Soleimani's assassination.
After assassination of Haj Qasem Soleimani, the lieutenant general and anti-terror commander, we have been witnessing a different situation. The number of attacks by the resistant forces on the U.S. troops in the region have, increased. And also, the U.S. has started a very confusing withdrawal from this region. The U.S. demise has sped up. We all saw how they exited and escaped, actually, Afghanistan. And the time has arrived for their expulsion from Iraq. The U.S. troops have come under more and more attacks in Iraq, and they have also withdrawn from some bases in Qatar. They withdrew the top echelon of the CENTCOM from Doha, and it's very clear that the U.S. is growingly becoming weaker and weaker each day. And this has been somehow the impact of his of the assassination of Qasem Soleimani.
Diplomatic efforts are going on in the Austrian capital to revive the 2015 Iran deal, known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. This is the eighth round of talks between Iran and the remaining signatories to the deal. The U.S. unilaterally withdrew from the accord in 2018 and is taking part indirectly. We've spoken to our correspondent in Vienna, Homolisky, for the latest updates on the negotiations. Let's take a listen.
The eighth round of the talks aimed at restoring the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action is currently underway here in Vienna. The latest updates that we have is that Mr. Bagheri Kani, the head of Iran's delegation, is again having a meeting with the EU coordinator Enrique Mora and the representatives of the three European signatories of the JCPOA, Britain, France and Germany. Today there were some media reports claiming that they have some information from behind closed doors, the negotiations that are underway, and those reports are saying that there may be an interim two-year agreement taking place between Iran and the remaining signatories, but that has been rejected and dismissed by sources close to the Iranian negotiating team. One source close to the negotiator said that media reports claiming that an interim deal is going to be announced, it's a two-year deal, or that some agreements have been made, for instance, on the future of Iran's advanced centrifuges, what will happen to the stockpile of Iran's enriched uranium. Any information claiming that decisions have been made on these issues are false and they're fabricated. And we even saw that Western media were also making similar remarks, saying that Iranian and Western sources are both in agreement that these reports are, quote, wildly inaccurate. However, sources close to the Iranian team have confirmed that the talks are taking place in a positive atmosphere. As you said there, Mr. Bagheri Kani himself saying that they are moving forward and that even differences when it comes to the issue of sanctions are narrowing. But this does not by any way mean that the differences have been resolved. They're still there. They still need to be worked on.
And now to Iraq, where the newly elected parliament resumes its first session after being briefly adjourned amid tensions over which bloc holds the majority. Lawmakers are now electing a speaker and two deputies. The process was briefly disrupted amid heated debates and shouting among lawmakers. The temporary leader of the assembly, Mahmoud al-Mashahadani, was attacked by an MP and transported to the hospital. Parliament has 30 days to elect a president to succeed incumbent Barham Saleh. The new president will then name a prime minister tasked with forming a government within a month. Iraq held its parliamentary elections on October the 10th. The Sadrist movement, led by Shia cleric Muqtada al-Assad, won most seats. Iraq is trying to recover from years of violence and terrorism following the U.S.-led invasion in 2003. Well, concerns are growing for a chronically ill Palestinian teenager held in an Israeli jail without charge. Amal Nahle suffers from myasthenia, a rare neuromuscular disease. His father, Muammar, says Amal underwent surgery in 2020 to have a tumor removed from his ribcage. Muammar says his son told him last week that he wanted to go on a hunger strike to protest his detention by Israel. Now the father is worried, saying his son is already very weak. The UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees has also expressed concern and called for the teenager's immediate release.
We are demanding his immediate release from administrative detention for two reasons: his medical condition, which is incredibly serious, and he is a minor.
Amal's predicament dates back to November 2020 when he was arrested in the occupied West Bank. Israeli authorities accuse him of throwing stones at soldiers and have held him for a year in administrative detention. The practice allows the regime to hold Palestinians without charge or trial for renewable six-month terms. Amal faces a new hearing on Monday, and his father is worried that his detention could be renewed. Well, just hours ahead of talks with Russia over issues straining bilateral relations, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken says he expects no breakthroughs. The bone of contention is Ukraine. Blinken says Russia has to choose between dialogue and confrontation if it renews its aggression against Ukraine. Moscow dismisses any such plan and has ruled out giving concessions to the U.S. Russia has also said it's disappointed by the signals that the U.S. and EU are sending before the talks in Geneva. The negotiations take place on Sunday and Monday. They also cover arms control, human rights, and conflicts around the globe. Russia is also scheduled to hold a meeting with Western Military Alliance NATO on Wednesday. We've spoken to political commentator Marcus Papadopoulos about the upcoming talks between Russia and the U.S. He says he welcomes the negotiations but believes that Washington's promises would mean nothing in the long term. Let's take a listen.
The forthcoming meeting between the Americans and the Russians concerning the Ukraine crisis. And I also welcome the reports we have been receiving in the last few days that the Americans may offer the Russians possibility of Washington scaling down NATO's presence in Eastern Europe, which indicates that Russia has, as many of us have said for many years now, a legitimate grievance over NATO's presence in Eastern Europe, which is a gross violation of the NATO-Russia founding treaty of 1997. an American pledge in writing would be welcomed, but in the long term, it would not mean anything. After all, America has violated the NATO-Russia founding treaty of 1997 by positioning NATO forces in Eastern Europe. Secondly, when NATO bombed the Federal Republic of Yugoslavia in 1999, the Americans, who are the de facto leader of NATO, violated Article 1 of NATO's founding treaty, which clearly stipulates that NATO will never use force to resolve a dispute. Mm-hmm. So an American pledge in writing is not worth the paper it's written on.
Kazakhstan's health ministry says 164 people have been killed in unrest that hit the country last week following protests over a fuel price hike. The ministry says the majority of the victims lost their lives in the main city of Almaty. It saw some of the fiercest clashes between protesters and security forces. The Kazakh presidency says almost 6,000 people, including foreign nationals, have been arrested in connection with the unrest. And the government says things have now stabilized, but counter-terror operations continue. Kazakhstan says Russian-led peacekeepers are now protecting several of its strategic facilities. Some small cities are still witnessing protests. They have continued even after the government resigned and the president restored fuel price caps. Well, post-Brexit trade tensions are dragging on between the UK and the European Union. London now threatens to take unilateral action that would suspend customs checks on goods moving to Northern Ireland. Well, the UK will do that and use Article 16 if talks this week with the EU fail. That's according to British Foreign Secretary Liz Truss, who's due to meet with EU officials. Following her comments, the EU ambassador to London said the bloc is not too impressed with the UK's stance. Article 16 allows either side to unilaterally decide if problems exist under the Brexit deal. Britain's Northern Ireland remains within the EU's custom unions for goods. Well, Brussels and London agreed that checks take place on goods moving between mainland Britain and Northern Ireland. They agreed on that to avoid border checks, but are at odds on just how to proceed in practice. Well, thousands of anti-military protesters in Sudan take to the streets of the capital, Khartoum, and in its twin city to demand full civilian rule. Security forces fired tear gas in Khartoum. They set up roadblocks to prevent protesters from approaching the presidential palace and army headquarters. Anti-military rallies have continued unabated since the army staged a coup on October the 25th. The military also ousted civilian Prime Minister Abdullah Hamdok. It reinstated him a month later, but the anti-coup protests continued. Hamdok stepped down last week amid a crackdown that has so far left at least 60 people dead. Sudan has been governed by a coalition made up of civilians and military leaders since longtime ruler Omar al-Bashir was toppled in 2019. And now to Nigeria, which says bandits have killed at least 200 people in multiple raids in the northwest over the last week. Well, the attacks hit Zamfara State. The government has called them horrific and tragic, labeling the bandits as terrorists. It says 10,000 people were also displaced when their homes were razed. Scores of others are still missing. Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari has condemned the attacks as an act of desperation by mass murderers and pledged to destroy the outlaws. The armed forces, meanwhile, say they've killed over 500 armed bandits and other criminal elements in the region since May of last year. Hundreds of others have been arrested. Well, protests against COVID restrictions once again hit Europe amid an explosion in the number of infections there. In France alone, some 100,000 people turned out in Paris and other cities to voice their anger. The government's plans to further restrict the unvaccinated are drawing a lot of criticism. Once approved by the Senate, the new law will require everyone above 12 to show their vaccine passes while entering a restaurant, using public transport, or attending an event. A negative test will no longer be enough. Similar protests were also held in Italy and Germany. Some countries in Europe have been reporting record infections, mostly blamed on Omicron. France has reported over 300,000 cases. Britain, Italy, and Russia have also witnessed record numbers. Jerome Hughes says there is a great deal of concern regarding the COVID situation in the European Union amid an Omicron-driven surge in infections.
There's no doubt, again, we use the word a lot, but there's a great deal of concern here in the European Union. And what the experts are saying is that they anticipate, just like we saw in the middle of January 2021, that in about a week's time, we're going to see a surge. We're going to see the results of large gatherings, people coming together during the holiday period. We saw it 12 months ago, and that's what they're predicting now in 7 days' time. So, you know, the true number of cases, actually, I mean, you talk about in Italy almost 200,000 new cases in a 24-hour period, and more than 150,000 in Spain. But the true number of cases, of course, is expected to be much, much higher, because different countries in the EU, the 27 countries, they have different capacities in terms of testing. So in terms of people having symptoms and trying to get a PCR test, in some countries it's relatively easy, in some countries it's very difficult. And also the availability of rapid antigen tests are also, that varies greatly across the EU as well, depending on the situation of the pandemic and how it's affecting the population. So, you know, the problem is, of course, Omicron is less deadly, but when you have, you know, the population here, 430 million people, you have almost 150 million adults who have not been vaccinated. But even, you know, with Omicron being less deadly, the more and more people it affects, even a small percentage of a huge number of people means that invariably that hospitals are going to be put under pressure.
And with that, it brings us to the end of this World News Bulletin. Thanks so much for staying with us.
This is IRIB English Radio. With you early in the morning. With you at midday. With you till the night's end. IRIB English Radio.
Aperture.
Welcome back to Aperture, everyone. First part of the documentary witnessed the rise and fall of gold used as currency throughout human civilization, from first gold coins in Lydia to their dominance of over 1,000 years in the Byzantine Empire. But what role does gold play in the modern international economic arena, and how has it made a comeback after the dollar took over for about half a century?
Under the gold standard, in which money is issued based on the reserved gold, the prices of commodities are more stable, because the government cannot simply issue more money. Also, trade deficits remain under control. Trade deficits under the gold standard refer to the effect of domestic gold transferring over to other countries due to an increase in revenue. If there is less gold, less money is issued. With less money, consumption and income automatically decrease. Export relatively increases, and the country sees a surplus in trade. Under the gold standard, the value of money is very stable, unless the amount of gold drastically increases. However, because of this, the gold era collapsed. The gold standard, in which issued money is tied to gold. When the economy began to grow rapidly, thanks to the Industrial Revolution, the amount of money needed to grow as well. However, because of the limited amount of gold, sufficient amount of money could not be issued. This problem became more evident during World War I. Countries that participated in the war had to issue large sums of money to fund the war. One by one, they began to discard the gold standard.
1929, Black Tuesday.
The gold standard faced another crisis during the Great Depression. As countries began to exchange foreign currency for gold in fear of the never-ending depression, it led to disputes over gold.
As it has endured,
we'll revive.
In 1933, President Roosevelt nullified the gold standard, and more countries began to discard it. After World War II, the world's gold gathered in the U.S., and the gold standard was gradually disappearing. In 1944, each country's representative gathered in Bretton Woods, USA. 44 countries participated, but it was actually a battle between England and the US, and in the end, the US won. Since then, the dollar became the key currency of the world. It was a defining moment for the US, as it became the empire of finances. However, during the Vietnam War, the dollar faced a crisis. More money was issued to fund the war, which led to increased prices and deficits. When the value of the dollar plunged, each country began to ask for gold conversion. It was the first crisis that the dollar had faced. In 1971, U.S. President Nixon declared the prohibition of gold conversion. He no longer allowed exchanging dollars for gold. Along with the Nixon shock, the era of gold ended and the Bretton Woods Agreement collapsed. The financial system in use today is the result of the Nixon shock. The U.S. is still home to the largest economy, maintains the dollar as the international currency, and other countries put their destinies in the hands of the dollar. The U.S., which had abandoned gold, now had the power to issue as many dollars as they wanted. The Asian financial crisis in 1997 that drove Hong Kong, Taiwan, and Korea to the edge of a cliff was the result of the U.S. recklessly issuing dollars. The reckless printing of the dollar can threaten any given country. This is all possible because of the absence of gold as a standard. The gold and the dollar, which were linked together at one point, now were on diverging paths. The ups and downs of civilizations and currency have a special relationship. If a strong civilization appears, its currency becomes strong as well. And if the currency value falls, the civilization also wanes. Whether they were coins or paper money, overissuance of money always led to the collapse of an empire.
A powerful government means powerful economy. The reason why the government is powerful because the economic system is so strong and the people work hard, make money, pay the tax. So the government can get more and more tax, which has a lot of wealth and a lot of spending power, which keep the government strong, keep the country or empire strong. But why such system can have a stronger economy compared to others, I think money is a big issue. It's a very important.
Ancient Rome is the representative case where the empire's history followed the ups and downs of currency. Once ancient Rome expanded to the Mediterranean Sea, the circulation range of the currency did as well. The expansion of the local currency led to stronger national power through the acquisition of local resources. Periods of stable prices and a booming economy coincide with the peak of the Roman Empire. In 54 AD, the peaceful reign of the Roman Empire ended under Emperor Nero. Nero reduced the amount of gold used in coins and made thinner, smaller ones. His successors also degraded the coins, and the value of money plunged. The currency system completely collapsed, and the government had to collect taxes through goods and services instead of money. The strong empire had reverted back to the time of the exchange of goods. In 476 AD, the thousand-year-old civilization of the Roman Empire collapsed. Even after the collapse of the Western Roman Empire, the Byzantine Empire continued to flourish and survived for another 1,000 years. The secret to the survival of the Byzantine Empire, despite frequent battles, was the bezant, the Byzantine coin. However, after the Crusades, even the value of the bezant plunged. In 1453, the Byzantine Empire fell when the last bezant was used up. The Byzantine Empire disappeared along with the bezant, and the Ottoman Turks became the rulers of a new empire. The special relationship between the fall of a currency and an empire can also be seen in China. During the Bukong dynasty, people in Sichuan made coins out of iron. At the time, about 20,000 iron coins were needed to buy a roll of fabric. A carriage was needed just to buy a roll of fabric. So in order to solve this problem, the world's first paper money, gyoja, was invented using iron coins as collateral. However, 100 years later, due to the government's over-issuance of money, the world's first paper money disappeared. Once the currency system collapsed, the Song dynasty lost its military and political power and collapsed under the Mongolian invasion. The Yuan dynasty that watched the Song dynasty's fall issued gyocho, based on silver, and created a stable currency system. However, the problem was the endless wars. Every time it faced financial difficulties, the government overissued gyocho, and the currency system collapsed. Once the currency system collapsed, the Yuan dynasty fell like all other empires. The national crisis shook the trust in currency, and the failure of the currency system led to the collapse of an empire. A strong currency and a strong empire were the two pillars that drove history. New York, USA. The Federal Reserve Bank on Wall Street houses the world's largest gold safe. In the 122 gold safes that are located 24 meters underground is gold that other governments, central banks, and international organizations entrusted. After the gold standard disappeared, gold that lost its place to the dollar disappeared into the dark. Then, what backs the value of currency? It's the world's key currency that is the foundation of international trade and transactions. The source of that power is in national strength. The British pound dominated the world's economy for 100 years. And then the US dollar took over. It was the result of the currency war among nations.
Oftentimes, over time in history, you find that as countries change in their economic power, the UK and then the US, reserve currencies change. But I think we're moving to a world where there's a lot more engines of growth, and it makes sense to have multiple reserve currencies. So this is a function not just of the United States, but really of the changing world economy. But it does mean, though, for the United States, if other currencies are used as reserve holdings, then there will be a relative fall in the demand for the dollar as a foreign exchange reserve holding, and that's worrisome if the U.S. has a lot of debt to sell.
The Byzantine bezant, 700 years. The British pound, 100 years. These are the number of years these key currencies dominated the world. Then how much longer will the dollar rule the world? People's fantasy about the dollar shattered in September 2008. The financial crisis that originated from the U.S. left the world in fear, and people immediately rushed to obtain gold. The moment greed turned to fear, the emperor, sleeping in the dark, awoke from its slumber. After 40 years of sleep, gold has returned. The price of gold rose 22 times in 2010, which is a record within a given year. Now the world is rushing out to buy gold. The central banks of each country bought 216 tons of gold just in the first half of 2011. The price of gold is skyrocketing, and the US and the dollar is plunging endlessly.
Even before the financial crisis, there were trends underway which made it likely that the U.S. would not play as dominant a role in international finance as it has in recent decades. You had the creation of the euro, a currency for a very large economic area, and the euro was beginning to play a larger role. In addition, you've got the emergence of China, already the second largest economy in the world and growing very rapidly. It makes it natural that over time, as Chinese financial markets develop, as they open up their capital markets, that I think we will see the renminbi play a larger role as well.
Just as it defeated England at the Bretton Woods Conference, defeated France via the Nixon shock, put Germany and Japan under control, will the U.S. be able to win the currency war once again?
Well, the United States is now in relative decline to the rest of the world. As you probably know, the 19th century was the century of the UK. It went into decline during the 20th century, and it's no longer anywhere near the major economy in the world. The 20th century was the century of the US. We're now in relative decline, too. The largest creditor nations in the world now are China, Korea, Japan, Hong Kong, Taiwan, Singapore. The assets and the money, the wealth, is in Asia now. The United States is the largest debtor nation, not just the largest debtor nation in the world, we're the largest debtor nation in the history.
Once the U.S., the financial empire built on debt and the power of the dollar, began to shake, the world began to debate about the new key currency. The one that's receiving the most attention is gold, that it has returned after 40 years. Is gold the omnipotent currency that will bring stability back, or is it just a mirage?
Well, the fundamental dilemma for somebody that's thinking of holding gold is that gold does not produce an income. Now, I mentioned art. Art does not produce an income, but it gives you a mental income. It gives you a psychological income. Common stocks, equities, or bonds, they give you a financial income. Gold doesn't do that. What gold does do is it gives you some security.
So as it stands today, we think gold is undervalued by a pretty good margin. We don't know if 10,000 is the target, but we do think that the difference between $1,500 and $10,000 an ounce represents the degree of inflation, true inflation, that we've seen in the currency. Now, if we were to use the same formula that we used from 1945 to 1971, the price of gold would be $10,000 an ounce.
Gold versus the dollar. The currency war has already begun. Gold is staple, but its production is limited. On the other hand, the dollar, with no restriction in production, has lost its stability. The gold standard was discarded 40 years ago after the Nixon shock. Will the era of gold return?
So I don't see gold coming back anytime soon. But if we had a serious crisis and there was nothing else, people might grab for the gold standard. But remember, the gold standard has many flaws as well.
I do not see gold playing an official part of a formal payment system. It's not convenient to exchange. It's not as stable in value as a basket of national currencies.
I think there's a pretty good chance that the gold standard will come back, although timing is a very difficult thing to try to handicap. It may come as a result of policy, but in practical terms, it's probably going to be the marketplace that drives the gold standard back into widespread acceptance.
The new key currency that will follow the British pound of the 19th century and the dollar of the 20th century. The birth of a new key currency begins from people's trust. In the midst of the world economic crisis, we are at a point where we must decide the future key currency.
Gold actually is not a government decision. We use this as a money. I think gold in the history, it's been chosen by the market. People trust gold. So when the people trust that gold or silver, so the government just use that as the money. If that's the case, I think probably in the future or in the current world, probably we should let the market to choose which one is better solution for our current problem.
No one knows which currency to trust and which currency to choose as the key currency. But even at this moment, gold reflects humans' desire most accurately. A soft, yellow, sparkling piece of metal. It is gold that the universe created. But humans gave it power, honor, and immortality. And the destiny of gold changed. Gold has written history for thousands of years. And humanity abandoned gold 40 years ago. But gold has returned. Will the return of gold be a blessing or a disaster? We stand before gold once again.
Well, with increasing political instability inside the U.S. and with the aftermath of the economic meltdown, perhaps the days of the dollar are in decline, and as history has proven to previous empires, when the dollar is out, U.S. dominance around the world will also fade away. Well, that's a wrap for this week, but join me again here next time on Aperture. Goodbye for now.
وقضى ربك ألا تعبدوا إلا إياه وبالوالدين إحسانا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except Him, and He has enjoined kindness to parents.
For humanity.
Sayyid Abdullah Al-Musawi.
A'udhu billahi min ash-shaytanir la'in ar-rajim. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Brothers and sisters, dear listeners, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and welcome to IRIB English Radio, and you are listening to the program For Humanity. We are looking at human rights from the perspective of the commander of the faithful, Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali alayhi as-salam, and especially the justice of Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali alayhi salamullah. Amir al-Mu'mineen assessed things correctly and engaged himself in his task to achieve human rights and to achieve justice fearlessly according to his calculation, of course. He never entertained any doubt with regard to anything related to public affairs, which many of those were before him and after him. Not only did they entertain the idea, but they enforced it on the outside that the public welfare should be under the service. People should serve them, and whatever they own is theirs, you know, belong to the rulers, not to people. Where Amir al-Mu'mineen, no, that wasn't him. As and when any officer or governor oppressed the subject, Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam neither sits quiet nor confide at their actions. When he sees people doing the wrong thing, especially governors, those who are in power, he doesn't say, well, it's not my business, or he comes with them, you know, because they are the rulers. No, he never displayed slackness when he found that some person had formed a group against the true government. At times, his plan to achieve his ends were opposed not only to the wishes of the enemies, but to those of his friends as well. But he did not mind this at all. He said, مَا تَرَكَ لَيِّ الْحَقُّ مِنْ صَدِيقٍ. The truth has left me no friends at all. All this was done by him so that the right of every person to lead a peaceful life might be ensured. Because Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullah alayhi, when he was trying to apply his own government, groups were formed against him, wars were raised against him, even by the wife of the Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi wa sallam herself in the Battle of Kamal, in the Kamal. And then you have Safin with Muawiyah, then you have Nahrawan, and then you have, you know, all these battles were only raised because Ali was establishing a system of justice. In the Kamal, Aisha came to him seeking inheritance, and he says to her, well, we don't have such a thing, because you guys denied Fatima her inheritance. I only give you your right. I'm not going to give you more. Talha wa Zubair wanted to have position. Amir al-Mu'mineen said, we don't have such a system. We only give position to those who are worthy and fit. Thus you have the Jamal. When Muawiyah refused to step down from the government position that was given to him forcefully by one of the previous so-called Khalifs, Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullah alayhi had to go to war against him, because Amir al-Mu'mineen wanted to achieve a human right. He wanted to achieve justice. He wanted people to live in peace, to live in prosperity. And as long as there's a tyrant taking that from them, Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullah alayhi was not going to sit quietly nor connive with their action. Therefore, he had to do what needs to be done. Let us take a break and then we continue right after.
Dear listeners, you are listening to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. You can send us your emails, comments, and questions at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, brothers and sisters, and you are listening to the program For Humanity, coming to you from IRIB English Radio. Imam Ali alayhi salam, he had a clear understanding of how dangerous things will be and how people were divided into two classes, and to prefer one of them to the other. This will retard the intellect, create malice in the spirits, and introduce oppression and injustice in the judgment and in the transactions, and all sorts of mischiefs and corruption will appear. So he was put in an environment where he had these two groups, and these two groups were divided, those who seek justice and those who seek corruption. And Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullah alayhi understood how dangerous the situation is and how sensitive it is. The result will be that ambition for life will die, and that people will become pessimistic and will entertain ill will towards one another. Consequently, consequently, society will be ruined. So long as these two classes exist in a society, a conflict between them is inevitable, and it will involve the losses of many lives, as we saw in the battles between Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam and those before him. So Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullah alayhi tried his best in establishing justice and equality amongst people is to eliminate these two classes and have one class, just one piece of Islam. Or even Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says in the Quran, وَاَعْتَصُمُوا بِحَبْلِ اللَّهِ جَمِيعًا وَلَا تَفَرَّقُوا. Hold on to the rope of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and do not be divided. As long as there are groups within one faith, within one religion, then surely rights will be taken. Surely people will be killed. It happened at the time of Amir al-Mu'mineen before him, and continued until our modern day today, where you see one group who claims to be Muslims are killing, blowing themselves up in another group who are also Muslims. And you gotta ask yourself, what happened, what went wrong? So Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam, and during his time, he made it his mission to eliminate the classes, and he understood the dangers of it, and he understood exactly the cost he has to pay, which is his life. But did that stop Amir al-Mu'mineen from trying to seek and achieve his aim and his goal? Of course it didn't. If it meant that Ali alayhi salam killed in his prostration in the Masjid of Kufa for trying to uphold justice, peace, and equality for mankind, so be it. That's the price he gave, and that's the price that me and you have to hold at a high regard. Thank you for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa alihi. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa alihi. Allahumma salli ala محمد وآله اللهم صل على محمد وآله صل على محمد وآله صل على محمد وآله صل على محمد وآله.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 49 meters, 6040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or BAT 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pastorday.com/en. And now, you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.